Just like the White House press corps when you're doing a briefing.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, everybody was where people were pleased with your briefing when you did your briefing.
The market didn't collapse. No wars were inadvertently started. So
right. Yeah.
It went okay.
There was a deputy who worked on press for the NSC who was told when he started his job, because the NSC personal office would brief and brief about national security and also about foreign policy, he was asked about what the goals should be of the briefings that he was going to do. And he was told, this was in the Clinton White House, and he was told, our foreign policy should be the same after the briefing as it was at the beginning.
That's pretty good advice.
That's right. So you didn't, because inadvertently a press secretary can say something, particularly in dealing with financial markets.
Right.
Well, tell us, Bill, how you got into this business. How did you get to the White House?
Well, prior to this, I was working on the Obama campaign, where I was from the beginning.
And that's January 2007?
That's when I started, right.
Yeah.
There was just four of us at the time. And it was me, the current communications director, Dan Pfeiffer, Katie Johnson, who's now the president's secretary, and David Plouffe, the campaign manager. I mean, it was so small, I set up the wireless router when we got started, which sort of puts a different view of the communications operation.
Uh-huh.
But before that, I worked for Rahm Emanuel at the DCCC, which is the part of the Democratic Party that focuses on House races. Prior to that, I worked for Senator Dick Durbin and presidential candidate John Kerry and Dick Ephart and Tom Harkin, sort of a bunch of Midwestern folks on the way to get into the White House.
How did you get there? I mean, what was your route? Were you a political science major in college?
Nope, I majored in English literature. Mm-hmm. After I bounced around a lot, I did religious studies, I did women's studies, I did American studies, I did all sorts of things. And I just decided I liked reading, so I decided to stick with English literature.
Uh-huh.
And then after college, I worked in the private sector for Target at their community relations department in Minneapolis, and decided that it wasn't the thing that I really had a passion for, so I left there and volunteered on the Gore campaign. Intended bar to make money, and that turned into a job working for a member of Congress from Minnesota, Bill Luther,
uh-huh.
who really got me my start.
That's interesting. Well, most of your work then was campaign work. You know, obviously before you came into the White House, you hadn't been in a White House before,
right?
And an awful
lot of it was
campaign.
It was a mix because Congressman Luther's office was I was with him on Capitol Hill. Even though he was a competitive race that was in cycle, so it was very focused on the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And then Senator Harkin, it was in his Senate office, and Dick Durbin was in his Senate office. So there's sort of, it's not quite half and half because most of it was spent campaigning, but there's a little bit of a mix.
One of the things that seems, looking back on the first year to have happened, is that the switch from campaigning to governing has maybe not been totally smooth. Can you tell us about that? What the differences are in the rhythms that you would have on a campaign, and what the rhythms are in governing?
Well, the campaign, being in Chicago for 2 years working on the presidential campaign, was a real challenge because I was far away from my wife, who was here in D.C., and B, it's just, you know, you're surrounded by a group of a couple hundred people who are just singularly focused on one objective, which is getting the president, then senator, elected president. And so we're up at 4:30 every day, and you're going through the grind of trying to keep up with every single news story that happens, because it all can be end up being a bigger challenge than it ought to be if you don't take care of it right away. And when we got out to the White House after we won, a big difference is that there's a larger infrastructure around the communications operation. The communications apparatus itself may get a little bigger centrally because you've got folks who are focused on the web and a much bigger speech writing team and national security press and things like that. But the apparatus around the communications operation is much larger from a policy standpoint. So you have a lot of support in the communications realm, but you're also supporting the policy aspect of what you're doing as well. Because when you're on a campaign, policy is often it's communicated through the press to give a sense of who the candidate is mm-hmm. and why they ought to be elected. But when you're president, it's what you're doing, as opposed to just telling people about it. So a big difference is that the infrastructure. And then also politics and campaigns, as David Plouffe often says, are an exercise in choices, letting people know this is what we stand for, this is where they are, and you can make a decision. When you're in Washington and you're the ruling party and the president and you're in the White House, you're much less judged against anything else than you are just in a vacuum, which has particular challenges because instead of comparing your policy prescription for one thing against what somebody else has to say about what you ought to do, be it on healthcare or the economy or foreign policy, people are just picking away at yours without the context of what it might look like if somebody else's choice or somebody else's policy prescription were in place.
When you're in a campaign, you control a lot about what you're going to say and when you're going to say it. And once you get into the White House, you come up with a reality that as a candidate, you can talk about all of the things that you're going to do. But once you become president, you can talk about the budget. But the budget, the appropriations are controlled by Congress. And you can talk about health care during a campaign, but the reality is very different because it's Congress that has to pass that legislation. So you are just one actor in a system when you get to be president. So you don't control the rhythms in the same way because so much is going on up on the Hill. Is that something that was surprising to you all? Because you had a schedule for what you wanted to do on health care. And when you wanted to do it, but you really ended up having to live by what was happening on the Hill.
Right. I would say that the president is not satisfied with the pace at which we've been able to get some things done, and it is slowed down by the process on Capitol Hill in a lot of ways. And it presents a big challenge, because on the campaign, I mean, one of the similarities between the campaign and what we're doing now is that what the president does is he lays out his main principles and what his goals are for any of the policies that he has. It's the same in the campaign. It's the same in the White House. It's just trying to work those principles through the legislative process to see them become enacted into law. And, you know, there were a lot of successes last year from what we did to on economic stimulus to what we did to rescue the financial sector, the automotive industry, what we did on the Iraq war, what we did in Afghanistan. And the president's proud of that. But obviously some of these other things are taking a lot longer than the president would like.
Yeah. So I noticed that you all have talked about having a more muscular communications operation in the second year, that there were things that I think Dan Pfeiffer has talked about it.
Yeah.
That you all are going to be more aggressive in communications. And what is it that you're going to do that you didn't do in the first year?
Well, I think that Washington Post story is slightly overwritten to the extent that, you know, we do think that there are ways that we can be more focused and spend the president's time more wisely on what interviews he does for how much bang we can get for them, on what sort of events we do in order to drive home what our message is. But overall, it's more a matter of just focusing. It's not a revamping of the strategy or anything like that. I mean, there are some changes that have been made over the course of the last couple of weeks and months, using technology a little bit differently. Dan Pfeiffer more actively is using the White House blog to respond to different storylines that are out there. Me and Robert Gibbs are now on Twitter, which has been very helpful in responding to stories and getting information to reporters about different things that we're doing and some of the counterfactual arguments that are out there about any number of things. So we're trying to make sure that we're sort of keeping pace with the media cycle and Well, not just keeping pace, but keeping ahead of it.
One of the things I think that people don't think of the Bush administration as being any high tech in any way, but they had a rapid response operation that that reached thousands. And it would be if they disagreed with a story in the New York Times, they might call the reporter. But their real interest would be in putting together a fact sheet of all the ways in which the New York Times story was wrong and then sending it out to their various lists. And so they had a very rapid system that went a lot of different places. And I guess I've been surprised that you all have not had a similar kind of operation because you are, you know, obviously have used new media a lot more than they have. Robert Gibbs did one the other day in which he took on, I forget what it dealt with. Do you remember it?
Abdul Muttalib.
Yeah, and, that's right. In the interrogations methods, right? Yeah, and the various examples from the Bush administration.
Well, we've done that. Well, like I said, we've done that in some different ways, and in some ways, we are ramping up that effort to be more forceful in responding to things right away and making sure that it gets out there. Millions of folks go to our website every day. We've got millions of folks on our email list and. Even through Twitter, Gibbs already has tens of thousands of people who are following him, and it's we're trying to use all the different methods that are at hand to the best of our ability.
Do you find that sometimes that those the new media can be helpful to you in getting a message out, but also they can be used by others in ways that are maybe present some difficulties for you?
Sure, you've got. All sorts of instances over the course of last year and on our campaign when vicious and untrue rumors spread about the president being a Muslim or not being born in the United States or even on our health care plan that there were death panels, that there would be people deciding whether or not a senior could live or die based on their health care coverage. So, yes, there are dangers to the speed that the Internet moves at, but I think that we're doing what we can to mitigate that and to get out ahead of it.
And sometimes there are groups that are using new media to organize against even your allies, like MoveOn.org has been strong in trying to push people like Ben Nelson and Blanche Lincoln, who have taken a more conservative approach than probably certainly the liberal Democrats would like. And have been critical of them, and which in some ways makes life more difficult for you all.
Sure, I mean, you know, we'd love to have 100% agreement on everything that we're doing, but where we don't, sometimes it is helpful for grassroots supporters to apply a little pressure to get their representative or senator moving in the right direction.
Unless it could end up weakening them, and in their home base. Well, one of the most important sources of information that you all have that you...
Just real quick before we go to the next point, on this point about weakening them in their home base, if you look at some of the senators who are up for re-election, Democratic and Republican, sometimes you see that their numbers are low against their stated opponent or people who are considering running. And part of the reason that there's no enthusiasm is because they've lost support among Democrats. Not a majority of the support among Democrats, but they're soft with the Democratic base. So sometimes what those grassroots supporters can do is actually nudge them in a direction that gets some of their core supporters back enthusiastic about supporting them again. Sorry to interrupt your point.
No, but I was thinking that it also can weaken them with independents, and independents are going to be so important for you all.
Sure. It's all a balancing act.
Have you all been surprised at the number of people who in Congress who have decided not to run?
No, because we're still sort of at historical norms for people who decide to retire. And the storyline has been a little misreported in the sense that there are more Republicans in both the House and the Senate who have decided not to run, and in a lot of competitive Senate seats. Now, in the House, it's sort of a different situation. In 2006, when I was at the DCCC, we beat a lot of the moderate swing district Republicans. So, frankly, there aren't a lot of swing district Republicans left. So their seats may not be as competitive necessarily. But in an environment like this, I think anything can happen.
The president has waged a particularly recent battle on against the partisanship in Washington. I mean, it was a theme during the campaign and in the beginning of the administration, but it's come up again between the holds on nominations in the Senate and a variety of other things, the filibuster and whatnot. How did you decide to come back to that? And what has all the discussion resulted in? Has it? Can you see an interest among the public in the issue of bipartisanship, the need for it, and how do you measure it?
Well, you've got two different things that you're dealing with. One is that the American people desperately want to see folks in Washington work together to actually solve some of the problems that we've got instead of just bicker and fight about them. And then on the other hand, you've got a slightly changed political situation. With the election of Scott Brown, Republicans now have 41 seats in the Senate, which means that they can block most anything that they'd like to block from coming to a vote. And what the president said in the State of the Union is that if Republicans are going to require 60 votes for anything to get done in the United States Senate, then they have a responsibility to govern as well.
Uh-huh.
And what he wants to do is make sure that the door is open for them to come in, share their ideas, be a part of the process, as opposed to just sitting on the sidelines and, complaining about our ideas or making partisan political attacks. So what the president is doing now is just trying to do everything he can to engage the Republican Party. Get them to come to the table and say, what it would take to get their support on issues that are important to folks. I don't think that either party necessarily wants to get to November having nothing to show for the entire year.
Yeah, and the discussion has led to some breaking of the logjam. For example, on appointments the other day, the Senate voted to confirm 27 people. And that was after the president had discussed the issue. How else do you measure, beside results like that, as success on a campaign that you're on a particular issue?
Well, I think success is measured in progress on good ideas. So if the president's got a good idea and it becomes enacted into law, I think he'll consider that a success. When it comes to bipartisanship, I think there are different ways to do it. You can measure it in votes. I think that over the course of the last year, you've seen that Republicans haven't been willing, even when their ideas are included, to necessarily vote for different measures. So I think a good measure is how hard the president works to bring in members of both parties and get their ideas, and two, how many of those ideas are actually incorporated into what it is that we're working on.
Uh-huh. What about public sentiment, about whether you're moving public sentiment? How do you measure that?
Public sentiment in terms of whether or not we're...
Whether you're, number one, breaking through, that the public sees the priority that you have, like the president talking about the issue of the bipartisanship, whether that issue has gone through, when the public knows what it is the president has said, and whether they've responded to it in some way. So do you do that through polling? Do you do it through reading the polls of others? Do you have your own polls?
I mean, the only data you really have on measuring public opinion is polling. The DNC does some polling, and there's obviously a wide array of public polling that gets done out there. And, we certainly take a look at what's out there and what people are thinking and what are the best ways to explain different issues and what we're doing. Polls are obviously limited because they're snapshots of what people think at any particular moment, and they don't necessarily delve into what are the best policies, because something that's popular at the time might not be in the long term the best particular policy. So when it comes to what the president thinks he ought to be pursuing, it's much less an exercise in what the polls say and much more one in what's the right thing to do. The best example of that is if we had enacted to save banks, a bunch of them would have failed. It would have been a catastrophe for our economy. it wasn't very popular to help out the banks, and it's still not a very popular thing, but it was the right thing to do. And the president feels like at the end of the day he'll be judged by his success and the success of the policies that he's enacted, and not necessarily whether or not he did things that were popular at the time.
Yeah, but there also is polling, using polling to see what it is the public is thinking. And like if you're taking an issue that's an unpopular issue, for example, President Clinton decided to support a program where they were going to support the peso, and that was faltering, and it was unpopular in the public. But what he did was did polling so he could figure out what it was the public was thinking and how best to explain it so that people understood what it was he was doing.
Well, that is, that is one of the most important elements of polling that can be helpful, is figuring out how much people are paying attention to a particular issue, what it is about the issue that particularly concerns them or that they don't necessarily understand, and trying to explain it to the best of your ability. A good example of this is, over the course of the last couple of weeks, all the major networks have done polling on a variety of issues, but particularly on terrorism. And when you ask, when asked in the ABC, CBS, and NBC poll, how do you think the president is doing it? Do you approve or disapprove how the president is doing on terrorism? All three polls consistently had 55% to 60% support for how he was doing on terrorism. When NBC asked the question, in a different part of the poll, how do you think the president is doing on the war on terrorism? He had a net negative. It was 40 to 55, 40 approved, 55 disapproved. So the way you ask the question or the way people understand the issue can have a big impact in how they respond to the pollster.
What kind of procedures do you have built in where you look backwards? Where you look at, because a White House is very forward moving. You're always thinking ahead of, you know, today, next week, next month. But what ways do you have to think to stop and say, okay, what if in what we've been going through, what worked and what didn't work? Is there anything built into that? Are there any meetings like Rahm's meeting on Saturdays? Is that a time when you do that kind of reflecting, or is it just difficult to do it in a White House?
It does happen at different in different places, not necessarily on Saturdays with Rahm's meeting, although sometimes he can be reflective about how things are going. But it's something that's important to the president. The military always does an after-action report after any mission that they conduct, and it's something that the president thinks is important for different aspects of the White House. It's something that's important to Robert Gibbs, often after trips especially. He'll sit folks down, and we'll go through what went right and what went wrong and how we can do things better in the future.
Is there any kind of method for doing that, say, for the White House staff as a whole, like something that, say, in senior staff meetings or those kinds of things? Or is it just by groups?
It's more by group. I mean, the White House staff is hundreds of folks, and you know, the senior staff meeting in the morning.
Run from the chief's operation within the chief's operation.
Right. The senior staff meeting in the morning is more focused on sort of what's happening on a day-to-day basis and weeks going forward. There are retreats. You know, the cabinet retreat is coming up again, which is a yearly event. And the senior staff will certainly get together and take a look back. But you're right. It is more forward-looking than it is backward-looking.
Yeah. One of the most valuable resource in a White House is the president's time. And how do you decide how much time the president's going to spend with reporters and in what venues? How do you make your choices? Because if you know, we've gone over the figures, and if you look at the three types of interactions that a president has with reporters, whether it's press conferences or short question and answer sessions or interviews, you find that Bush, Clinton, and Obama maybe had many of the same kinds of numbers, but they used those sessions differently. And so President Obama has done many more interviews. In his first year, he did 161 interviews, and President Bush did 50 in the same time period, and President Clinton 53. Why does he favor why does he favor interviews? And what do you expect from the ones that you set up?
Well, the biggest expectation is that the president conducts an interview with someone or participates in one. And you're able to, and the president has an opportunity to have a longer discussion about an important issue and get into some of the details about whatever that issue entails. It doesn't always work out exactly as you anticipated, and with reporters you can't always make a deal that you're just going to talk about one particular thing. I mean, we wish we could just dictate the terms of what all the questions were going to be beforehand, but oftentimes there's an obvious issue or there's an obvious piece of policy that we're rolling out or talking about that a reporter will want to deal with. So what you want to do is get the maximum impact for the amount of time that the president is using.
Uh-huh.
So you look to places where you think you can either get a lot of people focused on that particular interview in that venue, like an NBC interview with Brian Williams on Nightly News, or you find a way to do an interview that other people will read and pick up in other media sources. For example, when we did an interview with Bloomberg, a lot of other folks picked up information from that interview
uh-huh.
for their news sources because they didn't necessarily see them as competition for what they're doing.
Uh-huh. And so do you have people that follow how something resonates through other news organizations and then through blogs?
There are media monitors, but also we're all, the whole press operation is
right.
Pretty intensively obsessed with what's in the news. So we're all big readers of what's in the stories and what's happening. So I think we have a pretty good sense of how it gets played.
And looking at the short question and answer sessions, which are sessions that the president has where, say, he's sitting in the Oval Office with a foreign head of state, like with King Abdullah, and takes a couple of questions. That's usually from the wire services, and those are usually questions that are on the issue of the day. That seems to be a form that the president doesn't particularly like to do. He's had 46, whereas Bush had 147 and Clinton had 252. And so you have very, very different kinds of numbers there, which I think there are a lot of things that go into that.
Mm-hmm.
But do you all talk about that as just a forum that's not useful because of the kinds of ways that the president likes to talk in depth on particular subjects?
Not necessarily. So the use of those short Q&A sessions can be helpful or productive if there's some particular issue that's out there that really asks for the president's voice, if there's an event that happens, if there's a vote in Congress, if there's
uh-huh.
just some very particular issue of the moment. But otherwise, you oftentimes can get the president in a room with a bunch of reporters, and they're just asking about any particular thing that has nothing
right.
to do with what's important to the American people. And so it's a matter of focusing the president's time and making sure that you're getting in as much as you can over the course of a day.
One of the things that you all have been able to do that other administrations haven't is that the president has done nighttime news conferences to a much greater extent than other. It's true in other administrations. President Obama had four of them, and President Bush had one, and President Clinton only had one in their first year. How is it that you all have been able to get, part of it is getting the time, and what is it about President Obama that the news organizations, the networks, give you all that time?
I think that it's hard to know what the Clinton and Bush folks went through trying to get time from the networks in order to do that
uh-huh.
prime time. So I can't necessarily speak comparatively. But my guess is that part of the reason that there's such intense interest in what the president is doing on a day-to-day basis, just based on how much the evening newscasts cover him, the entire top of the shows are generally just about things that the administration is doing. I mean, you've got the Olympics, you've got issues like Toyota and other things that come up, but usually there's two or three things that we're intimately involved in about the King's Cast. I think it's because our country's going through a kind of hard time, and people are pretty nervous about how things are going in the economy. We've got two wars going, and the president is at the center of most of the things that people have a lot of anxiety about. So I think that when it comes to getting time from networks for something that you're doing in prime time, they're much more willing to do it. Now, there's still some griping. They lose millions of dollars whenever the president is on for an hour of their time because they don't get all the advertising revenue that they would if he weren't. So they're not necessarily always happy about it, but they're generally willing to take whatever it is the president's doing.
Because people watch.
Right.
And you know, the Nielsen ratings are very good for the news conferences, even, you know, down to the fourth one. They've still been good. It's not in the 40 million range, but still it was in the 20s.
Right.
And
But 40 million is about what we got for the State of the Union.
Yeah.
So there still is a lot of folks who are
For the State of the Union, I thought you had higher than that.
Well, it depends.
You had 48 million with a 45 share.
There you go.
And a 45.
That must be with cable.
Yeah, I think they take 10, but they don't use C-SPAN. This is Nielsen ratings. A share is of those people who had their television sets on, how many of them were tuned in to President Obama and the State of the Union? It was 45%, which is huge.
Yeah.
And all the way along the line, I think in his press conference, even his July 22nd press conference had 25 million. People watching it, and that was a 32% share.
Yeah.
So for news organizations, the president is good news in that he draws people to those networks, and so they may be losing their advertising revenue, but on the other hand, they do they're drawing people to their sets.
I think that's right.
Yeah. One of the things that you're involved in your job is preparing information for the briefing. Can you tell us about the daily briefing and what the rhythms of it are, and what you look for, how you get information, and then put it together, and then how everybody gets together with Robert Gibbs before he goes out and help prepare him for the briefing?
Well, the days usually start in the morning, where I have a conversation with Robert and a couple other folks about what's in the news, what folks are interested in our press corps. And then we spend some time, there's some meetings over the course of the morning, and then some of the policy staff or some of the press staff that's specifically involved in the separate policies that are probably going to come in, and we go over some of the new information with Gibbs on, you know, either what the developments are, what particular questions are popping out there with the press corps, or any number of things that we think might come up. I mean, today was sort of a funny day. Were you in the briefing today?
No, I was at Baltimore.
So about before we went out, you know, I said to Gibson, I was like, you know, I bet you get a bunch of Twitter questions today. And he's like, you really think they're going to ask me about Twitter? And then we go out there, and it's like a quarter of the entire briefing where people are asking all sorts of questions. I won't judge them here, but
how did you know that? How did you think that was going to come up? Did you talk to reporters? Had they asked you things?
They hadn't asked a lot of questions about it. It was just one of those issues that had gotten a lot of coverage over the course of the long weekend. That seemed like an easy thing for people to want to write about on a day when there were a couple of big stories going on. But if somebody else was working on the big story in your news organization, it's an easy thing to just pick up and write about.
So what are the rhythms of your day, particularly in looking at the preparations for the briefing? What do you talk to public affairs officers in the various departments? Do you have a conference call where you talk to them?
Those conference calls happen.
State Defense.
Yep, I mean, that's one
CIA.
Call.
The
Department of Homeland Security, Health and Human Services. Basically, all the different agencies have calls with people inside the White House. My position is basically I get up sort of early and I try to get Gibbs and some of the folks in the press office an email by around 6 or 6:30 in the morning on some of the what I see as the new developments in the news. By about 5 in the morning, I get a clip packet of about 50 pages that summarizes all the major news organizations around the country, including transcripts of cable broadcasts and nightly news broadcasts. And I go through that, and I pull out the top.
At 5? Do you go through it at 5?
It's closer to 5:15. Uh-huh. But you have to snooze once or twice, right? And then send around the top 15 to 20 things, and you sort of go from there. And I, you know, just after doing it for a while, you get a sense of, you know, what are the network correspondents going to key in on? What are the print correspondents really going to worry about? What are the foreign wires really going to worry about? There's always some wild cards that you don't think of or you don't see. But for the most part, it's pretty clear from about 6 in the morning what the news of the day is going to be.
Do you, one of the things that comes out very early in the morning that a lot of people read first is Playbook, that's Mike Allen does for Politico. Do you deal with him in the morning and about stories? Does he ask you for responses on things?
Sure. Yeah, we, I think Mike Allen is probably the most important journalist in Washington. And I know a lot of the people in the White House press corps don't like to hear that, but everybody reads him. Everybody follows what he's doing. If he puts something up top in Playbook, everybody follows it. So, yeah, we have a great relationship. From me to all the other folks in the press office, he has relationships with people outside of the press office, which is sometimes great and sometimes not great because information gets out that you're not necessarily ready for. But, yeah, he has the one tip sheet that people really go to. And then you've got Chuck Todd's morning sheet, for some reason, the first read, which usually has the best take on the politics of what's happening around the country. And the note is something from ABC that people also widely read. But yeah, Mike Allen, I think, drives a lot of what happens in Washington every day.
Do people then take what he has to say and then read stories that he has put up there? Because I noticed that policy stories are not ones that sometimes that he doesn't. That he doesn't follow. Like, say, for example, I remember a story that I thought was really a good one. The New York Times had as a lead story about debt and the way that debt is going to have to be dealt with. In part, it came from Concord Coalition information. And I thought that was an important story, but it wasn't in there.
Right.
The story recently that Karen DeYoung did that was looking at the issue over predators, of whether by killing people who are our enemies rather than apprehending them and questioning them, there are people that, that thought that strategy was not useful. And I thought it was really an interesting question to debate, an important story, and that one I don't believe was there either. So there are a lot of policy stories that he doesn't focus on. It seemed to me that he focuses mostly on political things in Washington.
I think that's right. I think it's mostly right. But then sometimes he does focus on policy. It's hard to know the exact formula of what he considers important enough to put in Playbook, but he's doing something right because everybody's reading it.
Yeah, I think the time he gets up. I think he did a session with the students a couple of years ago. I think he said he gets up at 3:30, and to have it.
I bet he doesn't sleep.
Yeah, I know because people have gotten we've certainly gotten emails that are at 1 o'clock.
Right.
And, yeah. So you do wonder how he sleeps. But it comes out before 7:30, and so people get up and read it, people who get up later than you do. What do you do the rest of the day after the briefing?
There's usually a lot of meetings. Sometimes there's interviews that need to get done for different cable news outlets. Every day is a little different. Meet with reporters. It's all sorts of stuff, really.
Grab bag. So are you mostly involved in when there's a discussion about what interviews to do, that's one of your areas.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the Sunday programs?
Yep.
Are you involved with them, and mm-hmm. in what way?
Well, early in the week, there's a person on staff, Dag Vega, who checks in with all the Sunday show producers, sees sort of what they're thinking, who they want to have on, what kind of discussion they want to have, and we make a determination at the White House, a small group of people, of who the best surrogates are to go out there and give the administration's message on whatever particular subject that we're working on. He's got a hard job because he's got to balance the needs of all the different shows. Sometimes it's easy and we just put one person out on all the different shows, like when Brennan was out there on all the shows or even the president. But on a week like last week, let's see here, or not this last Sunday, but the Sunday before, where you've got Jay Tapper guest hosting this week, who wanted to do an economic interview. Meet the Press wanted to do a national security interview. And I think CBS was just focused on the Super Bowl. And you've got to balance out, when you don't have one surrogate who's doing it, balancing out who's going to go where. But Brennan went to Meet the Press. Tim Geithner went on this week, and everybody mm-hmm. was happy.
Uh-huh. Well, let's start taking some questions. Is Towson there?
We are here, but you can't see us.
Okay, yeah. All righty. Would you all like to ask a question? Who's going to ask?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Now, yeah.
Okay. I was sort of wondering about how you deal with the sort of complaints that come from the base of the Democratic Party base, and you know how you decide when is best to sort of confront something right away or sort of ignore it and hope it goes away and pays attention to it.
Well, that's a good question because there are a lot of folks, including our friends, who aren't always happy with everything that we do. The starting place for the president is not necessarily how does he keep his political coalition together. It's, well, what's the best thing that we can do and how do we get to a place where we can get it done? So when it comes to complaints from the left, there are people on staff at the White House who deal with different groups, and there's people who deal with members of Congress. And the best that they can do is explain what the president's doing, why he's doing it, why he didn't do something else, and what he would do given the chance to do it another time. If there's something that is of particular burn, the saddle of the left, sometimes what you have to do is you have to deal with it in places where the left goes to get their media, like primetime MSNBC programming, like Keith Olbermann or Rachel Maddow, or sometimes people at the White House do conference calls with left-leaning bloggers or pundits. A lot of times we have folks down to the White House to speak with senior administration officials about different things that we're doing, be it David Axelrod or John Brennan or any number of people. So every case is different, and so it's dealt with in an individual way. But we just try to touch folks as much as we can in the places where they get their media.
Here? Does anybody have a question here?
I was just going to ask you, what's your personally your favorite newspaper?
My favorite newspaper.
Is that like choosing between your children?
No. I probably read more New York Times stories than anything else. Uh-huh. I wouldn't necessarily say it's my favorite, but it's certainly it has like the largest news staff it covers more political issues in depth than any other news organization. But there's great reporters at the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. But yeah, the New York Times is probably sort of ground zero for political reporting in Washington.
Well, that brings up brings us back to the president's interviews. The president has done 9 interviews with the New York Times, more than any other newspaper. Is that part his interest? Like he spoke with Tom Friedman for a column he was doing. He spoke with David Leonhardt on the economy. Mm-hmm. Or is it the staff that, or is it both?
Well, the president is
the Times.
The president's a big reader of the New York Times, but so are most political reporters in Washington. So what I was saying earlier about trying to use the president's time to its fullest advantage, if you do an interview with the New York Times, it's much more likely to have a bigger impact than with other outlets that you might be doing an interview with. And also their staff is so big that oftentimes reporters can really dig down deep into an issue. Mm-hmm. And so you can deal with somebody who's really been focused on Iran or really been focused on healthcare costs or something like that. So I would say it's more a function of what's going to be widely read and what's going to give you the biggest impact.
Yeah, because one of the things in looking at his interviews in those 161, there is no interview that's one-on-one where he is talking to somebody from an only online publication other than allafrica.com, before the Africa trip. But that's the only one that I've been able to find. Otherwise, it's established news organizations. It's, it's the Times. It's the networks, particularly ABC, NBC, CBS. Mm-hmm. Is that because you figure that the new media can then take it from the old?
Well, we try to find ways where we can do outreach to folks who just have online sites. I mean, in our first press conference, he took a question from the Huffington Post, which had never been done before. But we actually don't deal with a lot of publications that are just online. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think of, even in the briefing room, how many folks represent publications that don't broadcast or aren't online. You've got the Daily Caller, the Huffington Post.
Talking Points Memo.
Sure.
Let's see what other ones. Politico, but although Politico does have a print
paper
publication.
Yeah.
Slate is in the pool
yep.
rotation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, although they're, I don't think they have a seat, but I'm.
Right. I think they show up some days, but not always.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. Towson, good question.
Hello. If you speak in support of a subject that the president has advocated for, but you actually give a point of view in opposition of the president, how do you normally handle a situation like that?
That's a good question. And with other politicians, that might have been a bigger issue because there may have been a lot of places where I may have disagreed with them. On policy.
That's a class that has to.
No, it's fine. I can be offensive.
No.
No problem.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I interrupted you.
For the most part, with President Obama, I do find myself being very close to where he is on policy issues. So it's not that difficult an issue. But ultimately, my job is to be a spokesman for the President of the United States, and it's to advocate the positions that he has, not the ones that I have.
When you did the briefing in the press room, because I was telling them that you often brief on the road on Air Force One, but you recently did a briefing, and how did you prepare yourself of how you were going to do it?
Mm-hmm. It's a little different from how Robert Gibbs does it,
mm-hmm.
and that maybe is just a function of the fact that he does it every day. But I basically just try to read everything I can about what I think is going to come up that day, especially what's in the newspapers that day. It's something that's difficult to prepare for far in advance because the issues are so contemporaneous to what's happening in that particular moment. But I try to read up as much as I can. I talk to the relevant folks who know the most about the issue. And then what I like to do is I write out what I think are the key points, the two or three key points on each of the things that need to get across. That helps me internalize it. And then I say it out loud a couple times in Q&A with other members of the staff, and then ready to go.
What about on foreign policy or financial policy? Are those things that you would write out so that you'd want to have certain kind of wording?
There could be instances where you definitely want to deliver a line exactly as you're supposed to deliver.
Sorry.
Like if it has to do with Iran or if it has to do with currency especially. But that's kind of rare. So I tend not to just read a statement unless it's specifically called
for.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, just kind of have it there.
Right.
Not on your hand.
Right.
A question?
Yeah. Hi. So one criticism of the president that's arisen over the last few months repeatedly is this notion that the president and the administration as a whole could have done a better job of presenting a sort of comprehensive agenda for the healthcare debate. The president was accused by certain parties of being vague on his stances on certain points throughout the debate, the public option, universal healthcare, et cetera. From a communication standpoint, how could president and the administration as a whole have done a better job of presenting a sort of cohesive healthcare reform plan to the public?
Well, in some ways, the president wouldn't disagree with what you're saying. He's owned up to the fact that he thinks that maybe he could have communicated the benefits of some of the things that he's advocating, and he could have made a better case to the American people and to Congress on why we needed to get it done. And frankly, just as a side note, I mean, the evidence mounts every single day on how much healthcare costs are rising and how they're just going to break the back of our economy if we don't take them on. But I think the thing that the president feels like we have a real opportunity to turn around is to give faith, to give the American people a little more faith in the process and how we're getting this done. And that's part of the reason that he went and he visited House Republicans a couple of weeks ago and took their questions on live TV. It's part of the reason that he brought a bipartisan group of congressional leadership to the White House last week. It's part of the reason that he's having another bipartisan group come to the White House to talk openly in front of the cameras with all the transparency possible about healthcare reform, what his ideas are, and what the best way to move forward is. You know, part of the problem that we've had is that a lot of this has been controlled by Congress, and you know, different people can have different opinions of whether or not we would have been able to make as much progress as we have without the process that we just went through. But one thing that the president thinks that we can do and is doing is offering a little more transparency to how we talk about it and how we arrive at what is ultimately going to be a very necessary solution to the healthcare crisis we're facing.
Okay.
If I could
ask
a quick
follow-up
question.
Are there any specific ways then that the administration is kind of trying to learn from the fallout, if you will, of the healthcare debate and apply those lessons to the current jobs bill discussion?
Well, they're two very different things, right? And on jobs, I understand. But on jobs, the stimulus was pretty effective at getting a lot of people back to work and keeping a lot of people in jobs who otherwise wouldn't have been in jobs. But the debate that we've got right now is that you've got a bill on the Senate side that's pretty big and a bill on the House side that's not quite as big, and trying to bring them together and get things done. And, you know, I think that part of the result of these bipartisan meetings that the president has is that they've been able to have discussions about what the best way forward is, be it on one large jobs package or breaking it up into smaller pieces and different things that Republicans say that they can support. And it's resulted in Republican members of Congress reaching out to the White House to offer ways that they can be a part of it and they can help. and they can, you know, put forward ideas that can have broad bipartisan support. Just this weekend, the chief of staff heard from some Republican members of Congress on how to do that. So I would say that this process of bringing more people in is the most effective tool that we have in actually making progress.
Mm-hmm. Towson? So let me say, get put in my oar here, because there's one thing that I couldn't figure out why you all didn't do in the healthcare debate, and that's bring in what I call the victims, is to bring into the White House people who represent, like, say you settle on four big issues that relate to healthcare, like medical bankruptcy, pre-existing conditions, and bring in people who represent those issues, that you're bringing in people that public around the country can sympathize with and relate to, and then have them at the White House, have them go to the stakeout, which is an area that's outside the West Wing where members of Congress often come and talk to reporters after meetings, and have them there talking about their particular cases. And that way you get it into the White House story, because reporters will always use what information they get at the stakeout. Mm-hmm. And it gives it the human quality to it. It's just not a general kind of issue, but you have very specific cases that relate to that. And that was something the Clinton administration did a lot of. Mm-hmm. There it was hardly an issue that they didn't have a group of victims. Sometimes an overload. And one of the people that organized those events was Rahm Emanuel. So I wondered why that you didn't unite together the experiences of particular people, mm-hmm. with the overall issues that you were raising.
Well, that's, I think part of the reason you bring that up is a function of the length of the debate that we've had here. Because early on we actually had events where there were people who couldn't get insurance, or there were folks who were facing bankruptcy, or any wide number of issues as it related to healthcare, both in the White House and out around the country. It's just that this debate has dragged out so long that none of the individual things that we've done, I don't think, have necessarily penetrated. And now we're sort of in a new place on healthcare, and that's certainly something that mm-hmm. that could be done.
Towson?
Hi. I was wondering, since ever since the State of the Union or the election of Scott Brown, the White House message has been jobs, jobs, jobs. But next week you guys are going to have this bipartisan televised healthcare summit. So I was wondering if you guys, from a messaging standpoint, want to get the jobs bill done this week or early next week, and then go into the healthcare debate with a compromise between the Democrats, so you can make the president look like a winner and successful for these 2 weeks. And I'm wondering if that's part of your media strategy.
That sounds like a great plan. I mean, we love having the president look like a winner. It's been our message and our driving strategic goal to make some progress on the job issue, first and foremost here. So we're doing everything that we can on that front. The House is not in session this week. So in terms of actually having something that we can pass and the president can sign into law before the healthcare summit could be challenging, but obviously something that we would love to do. I would say that Scott Brown and the issue of jobs are not necessarily related as it pertains to what's happened at the White House. We came to the conclusion that last year, the president came into office, he had a lot of different challenges that we were facing. There was a fiscal one with our long-term debt. There was a financial one with what was happening on Wall Street and all the different banks. And there's the much more in-our-face economic jobs crisis that we're facing. In order to even take on the jobs crisis in a more focused way, we had to make sure that banks were standing up, that the financial system wasn't collapsing all around us. So now that we've sort of addressed some of those other challenges, we're not completely out of the woods, but we've addressed some of them, the president thinks that we're in a place where we need to really focus on jobs. So hopefully in the very short term, we'll get Congress to pass something that we can sign into law.
Mm-hmm. Someone here? Nobody?
Really short question. Can we expect to see more question time sessions like the one at the Republican retreat? Because that was really cool.
Yeah, I agree. It was pretty cool. It was one of the coolest things I got to go to with the president. And I was sitting in the back of the room. The way it was set up, I don't even know how it played on TV, but it was, you know, Republican members of Congress were all sitting at their tables in this huge conference room at a hotel. And all the press was in the back of the room with a small number of staff for all the Republican members and their leadership. And the number of reporters who was there was kind of small because they thought all they were going to get was the president's remarks when he came in. But, in fact, the whole thing ended up being broadcast live. And to sit back with all the Republican staffers who were just sweating bullets as the president was answering all the questions, it was pretty fun. But part of the reason that was so successful was the spontaneity of it. And I think that the more you do something like that, just like anything in Washington, like the briefings that get done every day, sometimes they can be more about the theatrics than the substance. And this was an instance where the substance was front and center, and they were able to have a pretty productive exchange. So we'll look for opportunities to engage both parties and to get folks to talk about things openly. But I don't know that they'll all exactly mirror what that was.
How did the Republicans feel about it afterwards?
Well, I mean, it's hard to speak for them. In the reports, you had Luke Russert reporting that they said that they regretted letting the president take questions on camera, and you had other folks reporting that they were not happy at how it all went. But then there was a flurry of memos that came out that said that they felt that they did okay. I mean, the president didn't see this as something that we won or lost. He saw this as an opportunity to actually have a substantive conversation.
Because it seemed like that's what happened. And while it was spontaneous, they were prepared. The Republicans were prepared because they were people that came and, read particular things.
Right.
So it really didn't catch them off guard because I guess in the morning they knew that it was going to be, the whole thing was going to be televised.
Right.
And they wanted to do that. They wanted to ask those questions.
Right. Either way, I think they were going to ask those questions. It was just a matter of whether or not it was going to be on TV.
TV, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Towson?
Hello. I have a question. What is the greatest challenge that you face with having your own personal beliefs conflict with your responsibilities?
This can be hard. It's hard to, you're breaking up. Mike?
I said, what is the greatest challenge that you face with having your own personal beliefs conflict with your job responsibilities?
Like I was saying a little bit earlier, I consider my job to be sort of singular in that I speak for the president. And so since I have a great deal of respect for him and believe in him quite a bit, I tend not to, that's not usually that big of an issue. And there hasn't been any point at which I said that I'm not willing to speak about or deal with an issue because I disagree with him on it. The only time I've ever really had a conflict is my wife works for Al Gore's climate group, the Alliance for Climate Protection, and so sometimes it can get a little sketchy when I'm dealing with climate issues because it's, I've got my own domestic politics that I'm dealing with. So that's usually just about it.
let me ask a question that in an area that we haven't looked at, and that is the role of the press in governing. What views do you all have about what information the press should get? It's not just that they're an itch that has to be satisfied, but rather that that information should be given to reporters as surrogates for the public. Mm-hmm. Is there any discussion about that, and what are your views, and what are the president's views?
Well, the president's view is that the media plays a critically important role in keeping the federal government honest. And in his speech to the Correspondents Association, which is the big black tie dinner that happens every year, the president said to reporters, when you guys do your job well, it helps me do my job better. And he firmly believes that. And so it's his sense that we need to be as transparent as possible in our dealings with reporters. And it's our view that we have been more transparent than any administration in history. We've put out every single person who's walked through the White House gate since we got there, which has never happened in the 230-year history of our republic. We've put out more information about donors and people who finance our campaign than had ever been done before on that front. So at every juncture, the president is looking for ways to provide more and more information. So the president thinks it's important. The press plays an important role. He thinks that getting information to the American people is ultimately the important goal, and that's why we don't necessarily just do things via press release, or we don't just do things in briefings with reporters at the White House. There are things that, like the White House visitors logs, for example, are on our website, so anybody can go and find them. We do online chats with senior administration policy advisors so that people can ask questions and have them answered about what's happening inside the White House. So the president thinks that the press is important as a conduit to the American people, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, what he thinks is important is getting information in the hands of the American people.
Can you think of an instance where the president learned something from news organizations, whether it be from television or television, radio, newspapers, that he did not know otherwise, and that they acted on that information?
He learned from Fox News that he was keeping an enemies list earlier in the year. I mean,
Any things that were happening. Like, for example, in the Nixon administration, Sarah McClendon, who you might have heard of.
I have her book, yeah.
Yeah. She asked Nixon at a press conference a question about the Veterans Administration, which was then an agency, and a problem in the Veterans Administration that he had not known about it. And he actually afterwards had it looked into, and the person who was the head of it was removed.
Yeah.
So presidents do learn things from the press. And I just wondered if you could think of any cases in which that's so. Because he seems to be an avid reader. We know he reads the New York Times. What other newspapers and magazines does he read?
Well, I mean, when you're with him on Air Force One, he's looking at all the different, I mean, you name it, he's picking it up, Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or any number of magazines.
So in one of the interviews he did, I guess it was the one with Ed Luce, he was talking about reading the Financial Times, so that he read the Financial Times.
Right. Yeah, he makes his way through a lot of different media. The place where he, I think, picks up more information than anywhere else is probably in the letters that he reads from the American people who write in, because it's sort of unvarnished information that you're getting from a source that you otherwise would not be hearing from. Every day we get tens of thousands of letters to the White House addressed to the president, and there's a staff of folks who go through and decide what sort of response they should get, and the person who is the head of correspondence, Mike Kelleher, goes through them and picks 10 to 12 letters every day for the president that come in, and he reads them and he responds to them by hand. But it's often those letters where he finds new information or sees something new about a problem that he already knew about, but a new way to think about it, such that he'll hand it out in senior staff meetings and make sure that people read the letter and see what came in.
What ways are all those letters put together? So, for example, do you have aggregates so that it says that, we got 600,000 letters this week, and 400,000 of them were dealt with health care, and 200,000 of them were supporting your position, and the rest were against it. Do you have those kinds of breakdowns? Because, picking 10 letters, it depends on really that particular person.
Yeah, sort of
their
a powerful
idea.
Position to
yeah.
Be able
yeah.
to pick those letters.
So do you do aggregates as well?
Yeah, there's statistics on correspondence that comes in on a daily basis.
Well, let's take one question from each place. Is there another question here? Okay, well, then let's do two at Towson. you've already had two shots. Sorry.
We'll get one in the back.
Oh, okay, one in the back. Okay.
Hi. So, the freedom of the press, there's different indexes, but the U.S. is ranked in the 30s a lot of the times, like 32 to 36. Can you speak to that and government control of the press?
Well, if we're in control of the press, we're doing a pretty bad job. I hadn't seen that. I don't know what it's based on. I don't know why we would be ranked in the 30s, but I think that in the United States, people have the right and exercise it freely to publish whatever they would like to. And they certainly do that in the White House press corps, often to my dismay. But there's only so much I can do.
One of the things that I've been thinking about the nature of the relationship, one of the things that one would notice if you watch the briefing all the time, it would give you the impression that the relationship between the White House and the press is a very contentious relationship. But if you look at the individual, meetings that you have with individual reporters, you know, it's entirely different. If you look at the gaggle is a session that the press secretary has in the morning sometimes in his office, and it is on the record. It is you can record it, but there are no cameras allowed. And that's a very different kind of session. You'll find, for example, that people from many different news organizations get to ask questions, that you go through more people in a shorter amount of time. And it isn't just television people driving it. And television people ask one question, not six, in the gaggle. And you cover more ground because you take questions from, I know one day there was a Al Jazeera English person that asked questions, another a Saudi press agency, and that was in addition to the regulars. But it just, you got a better sense of the room.
Right. No, I think that's right. I think the cameras in the briefing room lend themselves to, especially TV reporters, being a lot more pointed with their questions or their interactions with the press office than they otherwise would be in the effort to create good TV. But it's not necessarily productive. And there's a lot of days where there's briefings and you wonder who got anything out of that exercise. But it's, it's something that, as a tradition, has withstood the test of time for quite a long time. And, I think the press, I think the relationship is mostly cordial. But there's certainly times when it's not, even when the cameras aren't rolling.
Yeah, because in a sense, you have a stake in cooperation, because the president needs the press. If he's going to get to the public, he needs the press in order to do so. That's the vehicle to get there. Reporters need you all because the president is a central feature of what people consider to be news.
I think that's right. And towards the end of administrations, you often see, I think from the outside, you probably know better than I do, but a deterioration in a lot of those relationships, because there's just been so much animosity built up over the course of their time at the White House that the relationships get pretty frayed.
The thing that struck me about the last year of the Bush administration is how few reporters were there.
Yeah.
There was once a day when the White House announced that in just a few minutes the president was coming with the Secretary of the Treasury, Paulson, to talk about a stimulus bill that they had just reached an agreement with Nancy Pelosi. So the only people who were going to come to that briefing were the people who are already in the White House, in the press area. And there are 49 seats in the briefing room, and there were only 18 reporters. And that was because the presidential contests on both sides for Republicans and Democrats were so interesting. And news organizations just don't have the money to finance both covering the White House and covering the races.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they were away. So it was as if he was a non-issue in that last year. One more question, Towson?
Hi. I just had a quick question.
The message of bipartisanship seems to be obviously a major one in this administration, especially on issues like healthcare and climate change. But in this political climate, how far is the president willing to go with reaching across the aisle when a lot of members of Congress on the other side, you know, said time and time again that they're interested in doing is killing bills like the healthcare bill and not really willing, even if the president includes their ideas in the bill, they're still voting against it. You know? So I'm wondering how far he's going to sacrifice the bill for their votes.
Well, it's a challenge to find a balance between working with some members of a party who have said plainly, like you said, that they're not interested in working together. They're just working on killing our agenda. But there are folks in the Republican Party who I think do want to work with the president. They've indicated an interest in working with the president. And if you look at the results of the special elections that have happened over the course of last year and the gubernatorial races in New Jersey and Virginia, you've got Scott Brown. Like, one overriding thing that sort of runs through all those different races is that people are kind of sick and tired of how things are going in Washington and the way things that are, and in the way that things have been done. And so what we take from that is that the American people want us to work together. What the political situation says is that Republicans are going to require 60 votes for us to do anything. So if we're going to actually work together, if we're actually going to make any progress, then it's our feeling that we are going to have to work together. But ultimately, the president is going to do what he can to govern. He doesn't feel like he was sent here to just get stymied by one political party or the other. He was sent here to actually fix some of the problems that we're facing. And he's going to find any way that he can to do that. So will he make concessions and try to meet Republicans halfway on important issues? Absolutely. But he's not going to let that process stop all progress whatsoever.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
You guys can turn your mics off. I think they'll probably...